If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Pixel Sift.
Hello and welcome to Pixel Sift. My name is Gianni, and if this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. On Pixel Sift, we speak to the creative minds of video games and interactive media, and we find out their stories, and we find out about what they make. What does it actually take to make those experiences that you love? Well, you'll find out if you keep listening. Joining me on this episode is my co-host, Mitch. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me. It's good to be back. Haven't been on Leeds in a while, but looking forward to it.
It's the Dream Team. This is episode 170, and joining us to share their new game is Emma Ramsey and Andy Yong, a team based in Melbourne, who've just made Eastern Market Murder, which is available now to play. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And we're going really, really well. We can't wait to dig into the history, into the technology, and how it all comes together when we learn about your game, Eastern Market Murder. So let's jump in.
Hey there. If you're enjoying the show and you want to hear more, subscribe to Pixel Sift on Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, or listen on pixelsift.com.au. See you there.
If you've ever wanted to walk back in time, taking the journey, finding out a bit more of the history of the streets in which you walk around on every day, well, you might enjoy Eastern Market Murder. It's a historical true crime game. It's a bit like an augmented reality, a bit like Pokemon Go. This is sort of a geolocation sort of situation there. But the people who would know best and who would describe it best are Emma and Andy. Tell us, what is Eastern Market Murder? I've just picked it up. I've loaded it up on my phone. What experience am I going to enjoy?
Cool. So Eastern Market Murder is based on a true crime from 1899. Which happened at Melbourne's old Eastern Market. It involves a fortune teller and phrenologist, and it's a pretty slippery case with a few different twists and turns. The guy who committed the crime, you really need to dig into his motives for doing so, and you can either do that by playing at home in your lounge room, or if you're in Melbourne, you can go to where the crime actually happened. In augmented reality, place the scenes, see the characters, see some of the shop fronts that used to be there, and then travel around to 10 different locations and try and unravel what happened.
Is it important to be respectful of the people who actually died when making stories like this in an interactive fashion? Because I've always wondered, a lot of historically accurate media, not just video games, how do you respectfully tackle the nuance of the story while still creating an interesting experience?
That is such a good question. So we had a huge compliment the other day from the great-great-granddaughter of the man who died in this incident, and we've been working with the great-grandson, and they've been involved since the beginning, really. It's massively important to us that we tell a true story and are respectful of the victims and their family. And, you know, we sometimes say that in the game you're reclaiming justice for the victims' family, because they were totally screwed over. And, you know, you sort of think that these things only happened in the past, but then there's also a reflection in today's society with a lot of the themes that are dealt with in the game.
And I think the relatives, they're right into it. They, you know, might have seen our, you know, one of our ads for the game on Facebook or something, and they contact us and say, "I'm whoever's great great grandchild," yeah. And you know, and then they just start giving us all this information and photos and
yeah, it's not just one relative. There's like about maybe 10 relatives across 3 different characters. It's been a bit bizarre. So, I wouldn't want to not be respectful because there's still living descendants now that could sue you for defamation.
Did they open up any, avenues in your mind when they came across that? Were they telling you little bits of the story that you maybe hadn't come across in any of the official documentation?
Yeah, quite a few things. So the story revolves around Annie and Frank Stevens. Their real name was Annie and Frank Cartwright, but Stevens was their stage name. And they have so much of, they have a lot of their stuff still today, like physical stuff. But they also knew all about, their romance from when they were teenagers, and they were in a travelling circus and spent a lot of time travelling around Australia. So they have all of these, little anecdotes and stories from their earlier life, which helped us, help sort of inform us for what their characters would be like during the crime. So, Annie's, quite distraught at the death of her husband because they were super in love and had a daughter together. So that was really interesting. Another descendant that popped up was the great-great-grandson of Constable Wolgers. That was pretty wild, actually, how we came across him. he was sort of in
how did
historical...
you come across him? Don't go any further. How did you come across this wild character?
Well, just leave that hanging.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, it's early on during the development, we try to test the game with, it's essentially a paper playthrough. So it's like a board game that we've drawn out with our own hands. And we tested it on a couple of friends of ours who live in Alexandra.
Yeah, but they'd literally just moved back from Canada. They didn't know anyone.
They have a little cafe up there. And after they played the game, Randy was at the counter and, I don't know, he's, I can't remember.
Jeremy.
Jeremy, that's right. Wolgers walks in ordering his coffee in the morning and Randy's like, oh, hey, I just played a game and one of the characters has the same last name as you. And then they found out that he was the great-great-grandson.
Of Constable Wolgers.
And he gave us some photos.
His auntie gave us a photo of him. So then we could, because before that, if we don't have photos, we kind of just imagine what they would have looked like. But he sent us the proper photo of him so we could model it off the actual person. Yeah. And he was sort of portrayed in the story as being he didn't want to – when the murder happened, he took his sweet time going in there and so much so that, another guy went in first and had his eye sliced, open and had to get it off. Removed. Appropriate response, both of you. Well done.
That was the gruesome part of the – one of the gruesome parts.
Yeah. We were like, oh, Constable Wolgers not like everyone's everyday hero kind of thing. And then the great-great-grandson confirmed that and it was his understanding that he actually got fired for drinking on the job. So I think that was one.
So he's no Poirot.
Yeah,
he's no Franny Fisher. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about why you wanted to tell a game that was in a historical context? Because you could have told any sort of game. It's great fiction out there that's sort of fictionalized sort of stuff, but why is it important to tell something that was real?
I think it's – I mean, it always comes back to us, really. We've been selfish. We enjoy, true crime, and I think there's I don't know, a bit of a movement maybe that true crime – is just so much more, what's the word, believable?
There's just another layer of depth to it. When we watch a series on Netflix or something, it's like we can't wait to, and I'm sure other people do this too. You're watching, you get out your phone and I'm like, oh, my God, did that really happen? And you're, researching as you go. And then when you get to the epilogue at the end, epilogue at the end where it sort of says, then this person went on to do that. That's our favorite bit. Did they get away with it? Especially if it's a true crime, any true story really, but particularly for true crimes, I just find them that extra layer of fascinating.
And I guess, and in turn, to turn that into, you know, a game sense, which seems like it's an underutilized part of the industry, we also just kind of went, well, you know, why not? We just kind of went, let's make a game that we want to play because we don't seem to find other games out there like it.
And the whole truth is stranger than fiction thing, 100% with the stories we've told so far, like they're just mind-blowingly bizarre. And the Victorian era was full of crazy things that happened. So we really like the era and we really like the story, and there isn't really anything out there like it. Not that that was the main motivator. We were kind of surprised that no one else is really dabbling in this area. But, yeah, it's good fun. We like it.
So you guys are obviously history nerds. Can't hide it.
Busted.
You must be familiar with so many other stories. Why the Eastern Market Murder?
So we came across it when we were making our first game, and we were listening to a podcast called Dead and Buried. And Warren Maloney, the great grandson of Frank and Annie, he was on that podcast as well as Carly Godden. And it was just a super juicy crime.
But then the most bizarre thing is thrown in there, which is that he's a phrenologist, which is kind of like long and gone. And so it starts getting really, you know, the story becomes a bit sort of twisty and, you know, interesting because, you know, you're dealing with something that's not here anymore. No one would sort of go, oh, I'm a phrenologist and, you know, I will try to solve the world's problems with my phrenology.
So I think it's the
layers. I mean, I know what a phrenologist is, but for Gianni, what I mean, he obviously doesn't know. Well, what is a phrenologist?
You've got a beautiful shaped head, Gianni. I'm sure all of your faculty
all of my problems,
areas,
no problems at all.
Wonderful in the self-perfecting faculty region. So phrenology was in those days, scientific study of the shape of the skull and its impact on behavioural traits. So if you've ever been to the old Melbourne jail or any probably old jail type thing, they often had the death masks.
Well, the Melbourne jail, you can go and see them there. They took like casts of like hung
criminals. And that was to study the shapes, the bumps and lumps and divots on their head, to determine what sort of
criminal they were
or any type of behavioral traits. And it's so sad because they used to do it to kids. It was basically just a way of being openly racist. So I think the multi-layered part of the story and being able to dive into all those weird things that people completely believed, and it was like a legitimate science for like 100 and something years.
And I think it's for us as well, it's a story based in Melbourne. We found it close to home, so we just kind of went, you know, this is something literally close to home.
We had our launch event for the first game at the old Melbourne jail with Ned Kelly's death mask right in between us during the speeches, and our sound designer and musician Sienna Lee was, you know, singing with Ned Kelly's death mask right behind her. So I think it was kind of the logical next step to do a game on phrenology.
Makes a lot of sense to me. Hey, can you tell me a little bit about, you know, the when you're making this game, you've picked it as something which is going to use a lot of augmented reality. It also uses geo-positioning if you're in place. Why was that an important way to tell this story when you could have told it in many different ways?
So I think as far as the geolocation goes and being able to go to the actual crime scenes, there's something really like spine tingling about that. In the final scene of this one, you go to the old Little Bourke Street Watch House, which is just like a brick building that's still there and is now Punch Lane Wine Bar, which is totally awesome because you need a drink after you've confronted the killer or three
steady,
or four
steady
drinks.
Your nerves. Like.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's something really, really exciting and, to use a overused word, immersive about actually being there where the crimes happened. And as far as the augmented reality goes, the two go hand in hand for the on-site version, at least. I think when you're playing from home, that we'd love to do other games that aren't in augmented reality that would probably be better suited for playing at home. But if you're into Pokemon Go or other AR stuff and you don't mind having criminals hanging around in your lounge room, then the off-site mode works just as well because the story is really juicy.
And I think one of, like, you know, go back to like an idea we talked about in the early stages of development, which was like, why don't we do like a bit of a ghost tour? So it kind of has the essence of that in it as well. Like you're going around to the actual locations and you're placing as this character, which is sort of ghostly appears. And then you have conversations with them trying to either interrogate them or, you know, get answers out of them.
Mm. And I guess it's not just lip service either. Like that building behind you, Gianni, it's not there anymore. Like you wouldn't recognize the area at all, but we've recreated Midor, he was the killer, his whole phrenology shop based on photos or drawings from the time and from details that we picked up in the newspaper articles and stuff like that. So to be able to go where he actually was and see his actual shop where he did business and committed the crime, like I think that's pretty cool.
I actually had a question about accessibility because obviously if you want to play the full AR experience, you have to walk around and access buildings and things like that. Is things like wheelchair accessibility, and did you have to go and scout out these locations to make sure that as many people as possible could get there and experience it as possible?
Yeah. So it's all street level, so it's all wheelchair friendly. City of Melbourne, so yes, we did do a lot of scouting in the early stages to see where the suitable locations would be. And we learnt a lot from our first game as well that because it's the sort of game where you need to listen really carefully, the busier, bigger streets are kind of off the cards. So this one's you start at the town hall and it's mostly just down laneways and then smaller laneways. And the City of Melbourne does an incredible job. They, during lockdown, they reduced the speed limit in all of those laneways to 20 kilometres an hour, so it's much more pedestrian friendly as well. And they've got maps that map out for people in wheelchairs, like the incline of the road and stuff like that. But we were very mindful to make it as accessible as possible.
There's no stairs or second level sort of experience in this at all.
Yeah.
We're talking, you know, close to more than 100 years now than this when this actually happened. How many changes in the real world have there been? And did any of those have to shape the way that you told this story? Were there any places you just said, well, we actually can't go to that particular place anymore because there is no way to access it? It's completely built over or anything like that when you were making this game?
Yeah, so Annie Stevens spent 20 years working at the Melbourne Waxworks, which is like a game unto its own, really. It's just, it was a crazy place. They had the Chamber of Horrors where they would put like, similar kind of vibe. It was like people who are into true crime today would have been into the Melbourne Waxworks. And she worked there for a long time, like 20 years. And we were very keen to include that, but A, it was a little bit far away from the other locations, and B, it's now Bourke Street Police Station. So that kind of took it off the cards because there's nothing. I mean, there's a really good dumpling place next door, but apart from that, all the interesting stuff is gone. So we reference the waxworks in another scene, but, yeah, that's an example of something that quickly got taken off the cards.
Yeah, you didn't want a whole bunch of people turning up with their phones, pointing them at the police station.
That's right. Yeah.
Like cause a few raised eyebrows at the people in blue. For your previous game, Misadventure in Little On, you were actually the winner of the Digital Storytelling Award, the Victorian Community History Awards. Congratulations for that, because we were talking a little bit when that all happened, and we didn't get a chance to talk to you when that happened, but now we've got you on the show, so congrats. But can you tell me how does that sort of recognition factor into making your next game, and what sort of things does that give you as developers?
I guess it's just motivation to keep going, that the work that we're doing is appreciated in different circles. So it was quite funny because the History Awards came right alongside at the same time as the AGDAs, the Australian Game Awards, which we were a finalist in a couple of categories. Mm-hmm. Can't remember. Mm-hmm. One category? Two? Don't know. And there was a few other awards at the same time, and they were just so different. Like the AGDAs had the host was like on that what's his name from The NeverEnding Story. Like it was just wild. It was really fun and awesome. And the History Awards was just very, very serious. So, you know, to have that that contrasting recognition from two completely different areas is really fun for us as well. Like, because it's great to open up games to other people who don't usually play them in a way that they really appreciate. Yeah, like very, very diverse audiences.
Is that the experience that, you know, you've had people come across who think that they're not into games but, you know, can totally get into this guided walking tour sort of almost experience?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Yeah.
For sure. There was a very sweet old lady that came along to our first launch thinking that it was a book launch. So we didn't quite get her over the line. I think she was about 95 or something. But generally we find the group combos probably the best to play together, like with an older person who can tell the younger person a bit more about the history and what they remember from being there. And then the younger person's telling the older person how to, use their phone and about the city and
how to place like AR characters. Yeah.
Yeah. And in the first game, especially because it was all about sly grog and brothels and opium dens, like there was some interesting discussions to be had.
Do you consider Eastern Market Murder an educational resource?
The educators do, most definitely. it's not something that we sort of set out to intentionally do, but because it's a true story and they're actual locations and a lot of what the characters say is straight out of the coroner's reports and newspaper articles, so it's like linguistically correct as well in a lot of the cases. Also letters that Meador wrote from jail in his own words are used in his part.
I think we set out initially to like just make a game that we wanted to play. Like that was the initial idea. We were like, you know, wouldn't it be cool to have something like this and be able to play it? but it's really cool, like, to see the people that have, you know, sort of gravitated towards it. And it is, the educators, the historians, and, you know, some gamers like it too.
People who like playing murder mystery type.
We'd love to learn a little bit more about you now. How did you actually start making games? What was your background and what made you sort of press the button on starting making a couple of different games, award-winning games, and now a second one that's just come out?
Games? Okay, we're going back in time.
Way back.
So I guess it was late 90s. Well, I got into games. At the time, I had to make a choice between I got into a course at RMIT. It was a animation multimedia sort of course, postgrad. And at the same time, I got a job offer, which I interviewed for and basically had to choose between this game studio or the course. I chose the money, basically. I don't know. And then I guess, you know, just sort of stuck at it for a while and, you know, years down the track, now we are making games together. I guess we took a bit of a break and we sort of got into an animation
By break,
business.
He means we set up our own animation
we
business.
We set up our own animation
business. It wasn't exactly a break.
So I took a break from games and we did a bit of animation. We moved to the... We had a bit of a sea change and we moved, I don't know, when is that? Well, towards closer to the beach. And then we We had a animation company for about 5 years.
Yeah.
You know, we could, you know, anyways.
How long have you got? Like, we've been together for 20, how many years?
Yeah.
We've been together for an extremely long time and working together for...
Well, we've worked together for quite a lot. I mean, just trying to think, like, we moved to New Zealand for about 4 years and worked together there for the same company as well, right? But so we're used to working together.
So obviously you must have a good working dynamic, because otherwise it'd be like a bit of a challenge navigating real life and work life as you go through that.
Yeah, it is still a challenge. Let's not delude ourselves. It is a challenge. Any couples out there, think twice before you start making games together.
Yeah.
But we had a great guy, Heath Smith, who helped us out a lot with the second game. He's like a proper game designer.
Or otherwise known as a marriage counsellor in our case.
He totally was a marriage counsellor for us, and he often took my side, which I, thanks Heath, really appreciated.
He sometimes took my side.
No, it's
not about sides.
Yes, it is. It's about sides.
I've had this conversation before in my house. Can you tell me, what are some of the things that you really love about making interactive experiences like this? Because, you know, you could go and make lots of different things. It sounds like you've worked in a lot of different spaces. But making an experience like this, what does it give you professionally, personally, that you really, really enjoy?
You don't know.
So I really loved it on our launch weekend, seeing all these people lined up against a brick wall with their phones. That brought me a ridiculous amount of joy, because what they're seeing is something that was there over 100 years ago, and they were so into it. It was like they'd just teleported to another planet, and when they finished confronting the murderer, they all just came out with this, like, what the hell just happened? Look on their faces, mm-hmm. Which was awesome. I loved seeing that. That was my favorite bit.
I think I like the idea of a person being able to, like, it's a very linear story, or at least, you know, on paper it is a linear story. You know, you can't really do anything about that, but the game experience, the interactivity. You know, people feel like they are making a difference. They have a choice in, you know, how they extract their own information. And I think, you know, that's what I'm enjoying. It just feels like, you know, the learning is just big steps forward. Even after this one, we're like, how can we make the next one even more kind of interactive, and so that people find out things in their own sort of scope.
We have things in the game, and I think we sort of take it for granted now, but it still blows some people away that they have to pour a cup of tea for a guy before he'll tell you his side of the story, and you actually have to, like, pick up the teapot, move physically closer, pour the, like, tilt your phone like it's a teapot, and just watching and observing people doing that. It was
interesting really cool. To watch people do that at PAX in a tight space. They'd have to excuse themselves and, like, you know, do things over people. And
you talked a little bit about some of those lessons that you've learned, and a bit of what we do at PixelSift is sort of sharing some of that knowledge there. This is the second game that you've got out now. I'm sure there were things that you learned from Little Lon that you brought along and said, oh, well, we're not going to do it that way. We'll do it slightly different for Eastern Market. But what are some of the big lessons you learned from this project that you think people should think about if they want to embark on this sort of project, or even any creative project?
The big one. You know, we talked about Heath, our designer. He consultant. Sorry, not to mess with, you know, the bigger companies he works for. But he came along to the first game, and he is right into he's always wanted to make a mysteries, you know, he's right into mystery games, you know, sort of solving stuff, and he just gave us a few sort of pointers on the first game, and we kind of were like, this might, you know, lead somewhere. He kind of also dropped that he works for design for big companies. So we kind of like pulled him along. And I think one of the biggest things we learned, well, one of the biggest things I learned was about how to structure game design. And the first game started from the ground up. We were like, this is the script, you know, like here's a coroner's report. Here's all the information. How do we squeeze it into this game? And he said, don't do that. Let's start from the very top. What do you want to achieve? And then what are sort of like three pillars that will hold that up? And then we basically structured everything underneath that. Basically, every decision we make, you know, with the second game, we refer back to our three pillars. And if it fits, then we use it. If it doesn't fit, we throw it out.
And I think from more of the producer writing side, which is what I'm up to, I think it's like recognizing what your weaknesses are or what your gaps are, and even that is kind of challenging sometimes. Don't want to admit that you're not particularly good at something, but having someone like Heath on board, Carly Godden, who did our historical research, she also co-wrote the script, which was really much better than trying to write it myself for the first one. My auntie in the first one did a bit of editing, but being able to have a co-writer and just that extra set of eyes and someone to bounce things off, it was just really, really valuable. And, yeah, like you don't have to do everything. Like I tip my hat to solo devs out there, but, gee, that's a hard road to travel. And I think the, you know, if you're like in the trenches and really in the thick of it, it's kind of hard to keep that objectivity about whether your game's any good. So having a few extra people that you can run things by, and it's just really, really valuable. And you know, there's no shame in admitting what you're bad at and finding someone who's good at that, and it's only going to make your game better.
Is it valuable as well that, you know, you might be focusing, hyper-focused on one particular aspect, and someone can come in and be that reality check and say, hey, look, you know, you don't need to think about it that much, or, you know, that thing is already very good. You don't need to panic. Has that been your experience when making this game?
Yeah, absolutely. And like the, especially through testing and seeing people experience it for the first time is so valuable. And I wish we had time and money to do more and more and more, even though we already did quite a lot. Because it brings that other perspective and that other set of eyes on things. It's just, yeah.
I think like, yeah, surrounding for one part of it is, yeah, surrounding yourself with really skilled people, and then the other part is surrounding the game with people with fresh eyes. Mm. You know, they'll tell you everything about it.
And I think it also goes hand in hand with, I'm not shy to ask people for help. Sienna Lee, you know, her kid goes to school with our kid, but she's also an absolute rock star. Like she was a literal rock star in the 2000s. And I was asking her about, oh, is there any sound studios down here? Because we live in a pretty small town. And she's like, oh, what are you up to? Oh, I'd love to get involved. And, you know, we've been working with her for 2 years now and she's extraordinary. So, yeah, just talking to people, and if they're interested, then do you have anything to bring to the table?
Just rope them in. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're good. Come on. Come on board.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's basically my go-to move. It works well for me.
Well, it's a great experience if you want to jump in and relive a little bit of history. It's called Eastern Market Murder. You can also check out Misadventure in Little Lon, which is the previous game available on the App Store and on Google Play. And you can head to truecrimegames.com if you'd like to learn more. Emma and Andy, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a real pleasure speaking to you. I feel like we could speak to you for forever. There's so much there to go there. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Pixel Sift is produced by Fiona Bartholomaeus, Sarah Island, Daniel Ang, Adam Christou. Mitchell Lowe is our senior producer. My name is Gianni Di Giovanni, and I'm the executive producer. And as always, we'll be putting links to everything we talked about in the show notes of this episode, which you can see in your podcast player, or you can also find it on our website, which is pixelsift.com.au.
And you can also come and join us on Discord. We'd love to have you there. That's pixelsift.com.au/Discord, where you can share your creative work and talk about topics and games and everything else. That's pixelsift.com.au/Discord. And if you like what we do, can we ask a favor? We need your help to share the show. So tell a friend, subscribe your brothers and sisters, and start someone's journey into podcasts, because we know that getting started is tricky, but once you're in, you'll love it too much to leave.
Next week, we'll be back with Pixel Sift Plays, playing one of the many indie games featured on the show. That's all for this week. Thank you for joining us. We'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator Hironobu Sakaguchi made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.